This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Dennis is, I've made no secret of the fact that I think Dennis is, you know, apart from being a mighty poet, as you've heard manifest proof of, but he is among the most literate men in the world. I first met Dennis, I think it was 9 years ago next week, in the mezzanine bar of the Abbey Theater, where then-President Mary Robinson had conspired to have a celebration of International Women's Weekend by calling together the great women poets of Ireland. This is an army that doesn't fall below 5,000 very often, so. But that night I think there was a half a dozen, including Julie O'Callaghan, Dennis's partner. And during the intermission for that evening, I had never met Dennis before, though I'd met some of his poems, and certainly, like everyone in the English-speaking world, had met his criticism of writers that he brought to us for the first time in many cases. And he quoted to me a line of a poem of mine that I forgot, and it was the time I first began to think I should take myself seriously as a writer, because Dennis could remember a line of my poetry, which I have forgotten. So it is a true gift for me to be able to be here and read with Dennis. We've had a couple near misses before, but to be here and to follow him is a daunting task, particularly after he did that thing where he kept saying that I was going to fly. This is a poem about a cat that I hate and a boy that I love. I should say in advance of it, those of you who have cats and love them, you do so with my approval. It's not the feline that I dislike. It's this cat in particular. Any of you who had met the cat would have the same feeling. I once wrote an unflattering poem about a former spouse, and at least one reviewer took it to mean I didn't like women. It was that woman, and only just for a little while. She got over it, and so did I. This cat. One of these days she will lie there and be dead. I'll take her out back in a garbage bag and bury her among my son's canaries, the ill-fated turtles, a pair of angelfish, the tragic and mannerly household pests that had the better sense to take their leaves before their welcomes, or my patience had worn thin. For 12 long years I've suffered this damn cat, while Mike, my darling middle son, himself 12 years this coming May, has grown into the tender, if quick-tempered, man-child his breeding blessed and cursed him to become. And only his affection keeps the cat alive, though more than once I've threatened violence, the brick and burlap in the river recompense for mounds of fur balls littering the house, choking the vacuum cleaner, or what's worse, shit in the closets, piss in the planters, mice that winter indoors safely as she sleeps, curled about a table leg, vigilant as any knick-knack in a partial coma. But Mike, of course, is blind to all of it. The gray Angora breed of arrogance, the sluttish roar, the way she disappears for days, sex desperate once or twice a year, urgently ripping her way out the screen door to have her way with anything that moves. While Mike sits up with tuna fish and worry, crying into the darkness, "Here, kitty, kitty," mindless of her whorish treacheries. Or of her crimes against upholsteries, the sofas, love seats, wingbacks, easy chairs she's puked and mauled into dilapidation. I have this reoccurring dream of driving her deep into the desert east of town and dumping her out there with a few days' feed and water. In the dream, she's always found by kindly tribespeople who eat her kind on certain holy days as a form of penance. God knows, I don't know what he sees in her. Sometimes he holds her like a child in his arms, rubbing her underside until she sounds like one of those battery-powered vibrators folks claim to use for the ache in their shoulders. And under Mike's protection, she will fix her indolent green-eyed gaze on me as if to say, "What are you going to do about it, slick?" The child loves me, and you love the child. Truth told, I really ought to have her fixed in the old way, with an airtight alibi, a bag of ready mix, and no eyewitnesses. But one of these days she will lie there and be dead, and choking back loud hallelujahs, I'll pretend a brief bereavement for my Michael's sake, letting him think, as he has often said, deep down inside, you really love her, don't you, Dad? I'll even hold some cheerful obsequies, careful to observe God's never-failing care for even these, the least of his creatures, making some mention of a cat heaven where cat ashes to ashes, cat dust to dust, and the Lord gives, and the Lord has taken away. Thus, claiming my innocence to the end, I'll turn Mike homeward from that wicked little grave, and if he asks, we'll get another one, because all boys need practice in the arts of love, and all their aging fathers in the arts of rage. Now, I should tell you, I noticed when I wrote that poem, the cat and the boy were 12, and now the boy is gone 23 almost, and the cat died at 21. Oh, well. There was actually this time, this was in the summer of 1999, an eventful year for our family, because I began to email. The cat was behaving in ways that, you know, unpredictable toilet habits. It was clearly arthritic. There were lumps around there that we first thought were tumors. They turned out to be bad grooming. But I was emailing my son at school to the effect, Mike, you'll have to come home this weekend and take care of Greta. She's very, the cat's name, Greta. She's very bad. You'll have to do the right thing, you know, which was to say you'd have to kill this cat this weekend. I've had enough of it. And I was at the same time making preliminary phone calls to Dr. Clark, our local veterinary clinic, saying that we'll be in Saturday, your last appointment, and after lo these many years, you'll have to do the right thing. And he was agreeable. So we met in this little, it was near enough like a confessional, a small square room in the veterinary office, and there was Michael with the cat wrapped in his arms and the veterinary, Dr. Clark, and Dr. Clark's comely assistant, who I think had eyes on my son. But and we were all there, and the conversation was going in the right direction. Like, Michael, you've been such a good friend to this cat. Now you'll have to make the difficult decisions. And Mike was nodding, and the comely assistant was nodding, and I, for my own reasons, was nodding away. And but there was this moment when there was this one, you'd have to call it a tear, I suppose, working its way out of my son's face. He wasn't shaking or sobbing or sighing or anything, but there was unmistakably a drop of water. And I could see that the young assistant saw it, because there was an awful lot of frantic eye contact between herself and Dr. Clark. And the conversation took this unseemly turn in the direction of, perhaps, Michael, a shot of cortisone would help Greta with. And I'm thinking that better be one walloping big shot of cortisone, because, you know, I've come for a dead cat. And I'd actually gone to the trouble of organizing a small box for the occasion, as we do. It was in my garage at home, and I'd had one of our assistants call the quarry and have a small stone with Greta gone. 1978-1999. And the doctor gave the cat this walloping big shot of what he claimed was cortisone. I thought it would kill her. She went very still, and he said, "Take her home now, Michael." And I thought, well, he wants her to have the good death at home. So and within a couple hours, she was beginning to seize up a little bit. I thought, she's going now, you know. But a couple hours after that, she was moving with a certain grace to her limp. And then 2 weeks later, she was walking around with a bounce in it and looking at me like, I showed you. And so it was Thanksgiving time. I remember calling Mike into my office with a cat and saying, Michael, do you know, we're nearing the end of the millennium, and I couldn't stand the idea of, like Martin Luther King Jr. and Mohandas Gandhi and Mother Teresa occupying one millennium and this cat possibly seeing two. And after all, the stone was cut, and I'm not the kind of guy to make a liar out of stones. And so I intimated it in so many words that if nothing else happened by the year end, I would drop the stone on the cat and the stone would survive it. But as luck would have it, Mike came home early in December from school and went out in the backyard with a shovel and dug a hole in the garden. Next day he came by about 5-ish, it's dark in Michigan then, picked up the cat, disappeared, came home 40 minutes later with the cat wrapped in a blanket, dead, and said, "Where's that box?" And I produced it. He wrapped the cat in the blanket, put it into the box, kissed the cat, covered it with the lid, walked out into the backyard, and put it in the hole in the ground he had dug the night before, and said, "Inasmuch as my heaven would not be complete without this cat, shall we pray?" I said, "You pray, Michael." I didn't say my prayers are answered, but he did. He said grace before meals and a couple of other of his favorites, and then he left. Came back the next day and lined the grave with stones and put the big one on top of it. And I thought, I'm very proud of this boy, He knows exactly what to do. And I thought, we should know as well what to do with our own people. We know what to do with our pets. But he did it all right. He just took care of it in the right speed, And as luck would have it, the boys conspired this past year to give me a kitten for my birthday. And it was a lovely we should have a cat, a tiger kitten, I think. And I was speaking mindlessly to it, as we do. In the morning, I'd feed it, and I'd discuss things like when I was your age with it and all the other things that the kids won't listen to me anymore about. I was becoming very attached to it. And I had put up a little space in the garage for it to live in because I prefer outdoor cats. And then one weekend, the oldest boy, Tommy, came home. He's a fishing guide. And he brought with him his dog, some kind of Malamuter. Imagine the worst case scenario. And then double it because it was like 2 in the morning. And then double it again because my youngest son, Sean, had to watch the whole thing. And we were out in the garden again that night burying it, And I thought, isn't it a strange world and a strange life that this, cat that I hated for 21 years I could not get rid of, whilst this cat that I was fond of for 21 days I couldn't keep. These are glorious and sorrowful mysteries, are they not? This added to the fact that, as Dennis is after informing us, there's 250 million tons of humanity. Makes me feel in particular like we are all in this together, Dennis. So thank you for that. This is called Art History, Chicago. It's not so much a Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Jatte as the point of order, according to Seurat, that bits of light and color, oil paints aligned in dots become the moment caught, verbs slowed to a standstill, the life examined. We step back wide-eyed for a better look. An assemblage of Parisian suburbanites in Sunday dress, top hats and parasols, are there among the trees beside the river. There are girls and women, men and dogs in random attitudes of ease and leisure, a stretch of beach, boats in the blue water, a woman with a monkey on a leash, a stiff man beside her, a mother and daughter, that little faceless girl who seems to look at us. And everyone is slightly overdressed, except for a boatman stretched out in the shade. He smokes his pipe and waits for passengers. But I have never been to Paris. I've never holidayed beside the Seine, nor strolled with a French girl in the gray morning as in this Paris street, a rainy day. Gustave Caillebotte's earlier masterpiece, 3 galleries down in this collection. So I do not know these cobblestones, this street, this corner this couple seems intent on turning. But I've walked with a woman arm in arm, holding an umbrella in a distant city, and felt the moment quicken, yearning for rainfall, or a breeze off the river, or the glistening flesh of her body in water, the way this woman's is about to be, that Degas has painted in the morning bath. She rises from her bed, removes her camisole, and steps into the tub 100 years ago. History's a list of lovers and cities, a mention of the weather, names and dates of meetings in libraries and museums, of walks by the sea or through a city, late luncheons, long conversations, memories of what happened or what didn't happen. But art is the brush of a body on your body, the permanent impression that the flesh retains of courtesies turned intimate, the image and likeness, the record kept of figures emergent in oil or water, by the river, in the rain, or in the bath when, luminous with love and its approval, that face, which you hardly ever see, turns its welcome towards you yet again. The Nines. Thus we proclaim our fond affirmatives. I will, I do, amen, here, here, let's eat, drink, and be merry. Marriage is the public spectacle of private parts. Checkbooks and genitals, housewares, faint hearts, all doubts be calmed by kissing ants, a priest's safe homily, those tinkling glasses tightening those ties that truly bind us together forever, dressed to the nines. Darling, I reckon maybe 30 years, given our ages and expectancies, barring the tragic or untimely, say 10,000 mornings, 10,000 evenings, please God, 10,000 moistened nights like this when, mindless of these vows, our opposites nonetheless attract. Thus love's subtraction, the timeless from the ordinary times, 9,999. And this for your patron saint here in the garden. Saint Francis in Frank Caswell's garden stands watch over hostas and daylilies and Frank's dead wife's cremated remains planted years back after ovarian cancer had had its miserable way with her. He was a young man then. She was younger. He clenched his teeth and had her body burned and paid the bill and hustled back to work like nothing had happened, like the stone bird on the still shoulder of her garden saint, which never flew or sang, but still remained solid and silent and ever vigilant through the slow seasons of that bereavement. One June, for no particular reason, he took the ashes out and scattered them among her overgrown perennials. And once the trees were pruned and weeds were pulled, the bird bath and all the bird feeders filled, Frank sat alone and wept inconsolably and prayed to be an instrument of peace and wondered if only a saint or a sissy or someone crazy with the loss of love would labor so to keep something alive. One day he swore he saw the statue move. Do you know, for the usual reasons my publishers asked me to write essays, crass commercialism, I suppose, they thought they might sell some of them. The sadness is we like to have poets around in the way we like to have, you know, good infrastructure and clean drinking water. Nice to have them as long as we can ignore them. So it's really a very fine thing to be in a room full of people who have come together for poetry. But turns out I like writing essays because, I like the sentences anyway. There's a this is just a little bit of an introduction, a piece of the introduction from this book, Bodies in Motion and at Rest. I assume this room is full of writers and readers. They seem to go together. People sometimes ask me why I write. Because I tell them I don't golf. This gives me 2 or 3 days a week. 5 or 6 the way my brother was doing it before he had a midlife crisis and took up rollerblades. But a couple of days every week at least, with a few hours in them in which to read or write. It's all the same to me, reading and writing, twins of the one conversation. We're either speaking or are spoken to. And I don't drink. I did, of course, and plenty of it, but had to quit for the usual reasons. It got to where I was spilling so much of it. This gave me 2 or 3 nights a week, 5 or 6 the way I was doing it at the end, with a few hours in them when things weren't blurry. With some of those hours, I would read or write, and I'm married to an Italian woman with some French sensibilities and 5 brothers, so I am home most nights, and when I'm not, I call. I sleep well, rise early, and since I don't do Tai Bo or day trading, I read or write a few hours each morning. Then I go for a walk. Out there on Shank's Mare, I think about what I'm reading or writing, which is one of the things I really like. It's portable. You don't need a caddy or a designated driver or a bag full of cameras. All you need is a little peace and quiet, and the words will come to you, your own or the others, your own voice or the voice of God. Perspiration, inspiration, it feels like a gift. Years ago, I was watching a woman undress. The room was lit only by the light of the moon coming through an easterly window. Everything about this moment was careless and beautiful, except for the sound of a sick boy in the next room, coffee and croupy, unable to sleep. He had his medicine. The vapor rub and steam were bubbling away. I was drowsing with the sounds and darkening images, half dreaming of Venice, the Lido and the Zattere, the tall windows of a room I stayed in once, awash in moonlight and shadows, longing for the woman I loved madly then. It was that sweet moment between wake and sleep when the dream has only a foot in the door that the day and its duties have left ajar. I wanted always to remember that sweetness, that moment, and knew I could not rise to write the details down. The sick child, the woman's beauty, the moonlight, the steam bubbling, the balance between the dream and duty, between the romance and the ordinary times, because the slumber was tightening around me, and I was searching for a word, one word that I could keep and remember till the morning, one word only, a key, a password by which I could return to this moment, just long enough to make a poem, a purse made of words to keep the treasure of it in. And I was fading quickly. My eyes were closed. My last bit of consciousness was clinging to words, then bits of words, and finally only bits of noises. The woman beside me, the boys labored but even breathing, the bubbling of the vaporizer, which became, in my dream, the vaporetti, idling in the Grand Canal, because it was the key, vaporetti, the password, the outright gift of sound, whose bubbling and whose syllables sound near enough the same as the vaporizer in the next room to let me traffic back and forth at will between a bedroom in Michigan and a bedroom in Venice and the moonlight and the beauty and the moment awash in ivory and shimmering images. I slept with the word. I woke with it. I rose and wrote the poem down. The women are gone. The boy is grown. The poem sits on the shelf in a book. I come and go to Venice as I please. The language is alive and well. So this is why I write and read, because I don't golf and I don't drink and I'm married to an Italian. And every day I sit down to it, there's the chance that I might get another vaporetti, another gift, another of what Hemingway calls the one true word that will make some sense out of what we're doing here. That part about Hemingway I heard on the radio. Keep your ears tuned. Words are everywhere. What, as St. Paul asks famously, are we to say to these things? Maybe it's not the word today at all. Maybe it's the number. The language is full of them. You could start counting now and never finish. Like words, they've got us, well, outnumbered. All you can do is hunt and peck for the good word, the lucky number, the truth of the matter. My father's lucky number was 13. He was born on the 13th and wore number 13 on his jersey in high school and signed his best deals on the 13th of the month and died in a condo that was number 13. He always said that 13 was his number. Who could blame him? So I'm looking at the 13th verse of the 13th chapter of Paul's letter to the Romans because my wife is Italian and I'm not drinking this morning and no one's coming to take me golfing. And here's what it says there, word for word. Let us live honorably, as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness, not in quarreling and jealousy. Now, that mightn't make the hair stand on the back of your neck, but the Romans were done no harm when they heard it, and for me, it sounds like the voice of my father. Not that he talked like that, mind you, but still it's a concept he could get behind, because he was the kind of guy who wasn't looking for all the answers. Just enough to get him through the day. Just one little something that rang true enough that he could hang his hat on it when he came home and find it still there in the morning. Unlike Abraham, he didn't want to be the father of a nation. Unlike Paul, he didn't want to save the world. He just wanted his children to outlive him, his wife to love him, and everything to work out in the end. It did. Same for me. Just enough good word to get through the day. It's liable to turn up anywhere. A good book, the good book, the bumper of a car, something on the radio, something your daughter says, something that comes to you in a dream like, eat more fruit, Adam, or say your prayers, which is what my sainted mother frequently says when I dream of her, or maybe it's something your true love says, like the time mine told me, everything is going to be all right. I believed her then. I believe her now. Or let's say you're standing in the shower counting syllables when it comes to you that 9,999 has exactly 9 syllables in it and is exactly the number of dollars you can deposit in cash without the tax man getting involved. Or line those 9s up, all 4 in a row, and they look like the day and the month and the year you're thinking this thought. Who invented wonders like this? Or maybe it hits you like a bolt of lightning, like preaching to bishops is like farting at skunks. What disgruntled cleric first told me that? These are words to live by? I don't know. What if Paul had written them to the Romans? Maybe they'd have learned to lighten up. Maybe they'd have gotten so schismatic after all, or maybe you go looking for the one true word like last fall in Barcelona when I climbed to the top of those towering spires in Gaudi's Cathedral, La Sagrada Familia. It's 100 years in the making and not done yet. Maybe they should declare it a shopping mall and finish the thing. Maybe they just like it as a work in progress. Anyway, I'm climbing to the very top of the steeple overlooking the city like any good pilgrim, and at the top I say, here I am, Lord, and the wind is howling in my ears like Moses on the mountain. Give me the good word, God. I'll cut it in stone and the city out before me. And I'm whispering so that none of the other pilgrims will hear me. But I'm saying it out loud. Show me a sign and I'll write it down. And you know what the sign said? The one I first saw when I turned to make my way down from those heights. It said, watch your step. In Catalan and in English and in Japanese, which is, I suppose, a sign that God speaks in all our tongues. Maybe next time I'll go looking in Venice. Maybe next time I'll take the gondola. Maybe I don't have to go looking at all. Maybe it will come to me on its own when I least expect it. So what are we to make of these things? You want to get some good words like these? I say, don't golf, don't drink, marry an Italian. It could happen to you. But maybe you'll make a different deal with God. There's other things you want instead of words. A scratch game, a good Beaujolais, a date with a shepherd from the Hebrides. That's fine. God knows your heart. God knows you want your children to outlive you, your beloved to love you, everything to work out in the end. Work hard. Have faith. It will. One last thing, a word to the wise. Like with me and my father, like with Peter and Paul, like with Moses and Abraham, when dealing with God or rabbis and bishops, any of that crowd, a thing well worth knowing is where to cut. I think I'll cut now with the two-poem warning. Actually, the one-poem warning. I'll finish with this. Preliminary to which, I should say just thanks outright, you know, to have a whole room full of people listening to you. It's like going to the shrink, you know, and not getting a bill for it when it's over. It's very... I know this is remedial for both Dennis and me, is it not? Yeah. So thanks again. You've been very good. Most poets have this method of keeping track of their favorite poem. It's either the first-in, first-out method of inventory, last-in, first-out, LIFO, FIFO, whatever. I don't understand. This is the last one that I'll read, and it's my favorite, as it turns out, and the newest. Refusing at 52 to write sonnets. Has 15 lines in it, and I was stuck for a title. You can try this part at home, too. It came to him that he could nearly count how many Octobers he had left to him. In increments of 10 or, say, 11, thus, 63, 74, 85. He couldn't see himself at 96, humanity's advances notwithstanding in health care, self-help or New Age regimens. What with his habits and family history, the end, he thought, is nearer than you think. The future, thus confined to its contingencies, the present moment opens like a gift. The balding month, the dull week, the gray morning, the hour's routine, the minute's passing glance, all seem like God sends now. And what to make of this? At the end, the word that comes to him is thanks.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.